I'm paranoid because we blew that one recording. I'm just making double secret probation.
Sure.
That we're not losing a whole recording session.
Okay.
So this is one in the can.
Yeah.
To put in the can for, I think, for next weekend.
Thanksgiving weekend.
For Thanksgiving weekend, because we're probably going to be super busy. This is an unapologetically me-centered rant.
Okay.
And it sort of combines, it's sort of an essay, as in I wrote it out this afternoon.
Yeah.
And it sort of combines some things I've been thinking about for a while and some current mm-hmm. events. But I wouldn't exactly call it polished. So it's going to be a rant. I'm not going to worry too much about it being too long
Randy.
Or too ranty.
Okay.
So
we'll hear it.
And maybe this will get some things out of my system such that I can be like, no, I've already said my last word on those things.
Said my piece.
Yeah. I don't know if I can ever truly do that.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
This, I think I'm going to call it the Democrat Diaries.
Okay.
So some historic context on political parties, and I want you to feel free to chime in and tell me what you know or anything you...
Yeah, I don't know much. Go on.
You know something about this stuff. You did take a lot more history than I did, although that was, you know, a while ago.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So I tend to get called out whenever I talk about the idea that either the Democratic Party is failing... or collapsing, or talk about voting third party. I get lectured about on Twitter, on Facebook, whatever, about how America is, did I just say how America?
How
America is a two-party country, and basically-
In the Constitution, it's a two-party country.
We only can ever be a two-party country
for
structural reasons. And- There's the seed of an interesting argument in there.
Yeah.
Because without runoff voting,
yeah.
or ranked choice voting,
yeah.
or a coalition system,
yeah.
and with what we call first past the post mm-hmm. system and winner take all,
yeah.
It's really hard, if not impossible, for third, fourth, and fifth parties to actually continually thrive.
To thrive and do something of value. They just get absorbed, like the Libertarians got absorbed by the Republicans.
They get absorbed or they're constantly just pushed to the margins.
Yeah.
So the American system does generally stabilize on two parties. That's right. True.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's done that historically, continually.
Continually.
However.
Yeah.
The however is the big however.
Part.
Right. This doesn't mean that those two parties don't change and change very significantly.
Right.
Sometimes they change to different parties with different names.
Yep.
In modern times, what generally happens is the name remains the same, but the song changes.
Oh, right. The content of the party changes.
Right.
But the name of the party stays the same.
So the idea that the two parties that we have today are the parties we will have indefinitely. These are our forever parties.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, in order to get your ideas and policies supported, the only option is to support the current party that you disagree with less. That idea is really quite ahistorical.
It's completely ahistorical, honestly. But
and
carry on.
In fact, we didn't require our ancestors. Did you hear buzzing?
Yeah, is that a fly?
No, it's like a noise in the headphone amp.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. I'm not sure why. It's just like a noise in the AC or in the power adapter.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. I heard it too. I heard it on our last podcast too.
Oh.
These, but just showed up briefly. I don't know what's causing it.
Okay.
It's harmless, presumably.
Carry on.
Anyway, that's ahistorical.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we didn't require previous generations
mm-hmm.
of people. We didn't scold and lecture them quite so hard about supporting only the two and only existing parties.
So there.
And a lot of the great political transformations in America involve third parties.
Involve third parties.
And involve transforming parties.
Right.
So I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to mention some of the background history of political parties in America. First of all, you were kind of joking about this, but it's true. The Constitution does not mention political parties.
No, it doesn't.
Nowhere.
Nowhere in there. It's not written in stone.
Washington was not a member of any party.
So there.
And he was also...
He's very important.
Well, his writings are important. He was cautious about the influence of parties, and some of the other founders have been somewhat skeptical of parties at the same time that they were engaged in them.
They were engaged in them and active with them, but they were
Hamilton
skeptical.
Hamilton with Federalist, and Madison with what became the Democratic-Republican Party.
Yes.
Democratic-Republican.
Which is what we have now.
Which is what we have now, but we'll get to that. Okay. So in Washington's farewell address, I want to quote him here. One of the expedients of party is to acquire influence within particular districts, is to misrepresent the opinions and aims of other districts. He means populations, groups. You cannot shield yourself too much against the jealousies and heart burnings which spring from these misrepresentations. They tend to render alien to each other those who ought to be bound together by fraternal affection.
Yes.
So that's a pretty deep statement, actually, and probably requires some unpacking for modern language. He was basically talking about solidarity.
Yes. So there are people with whom you should have solidarity by every conceivable, like you're from the same region, you belong to the same religious group, you belong to the same racial or ethnic group. You have a lot of shared background.
Maybe you have the same class struggle.
Maybe you share the same class struggle.
Or maybe you both are metalsmiths and you really should band together to form a metalsmithing union. Or
whatever, you know. Right?
But if you're opposite sides of the political party divide, you'll find yourself alienated.
Fighting against each other.
Yeah.
Even though you're natural allies.
Right. So that seemed like an important statement to me.
I mean, for example, there's a certain way in which every single person in the Huron River watershed has shared interests. Some very fundamental shared interests.
Yeah, about, you know, land use and
that watershed covers Milford, Brighton, Ann Arbor, and Ypsilanti into Wayne County.
Yeah. No, it's huge.
And the political divides between those people
are bigger
than the fundamental reality that unites them.
Sure.
And that's kind of what he's getting at.
Yeah.
Is the way in which people who are natural allies and should be natural allies and should be working together politically will work feverishly against each other because they belong to opposing parties.
Yep. So he wrote about this, quote, the spirit of party, not like partying. Woohoo! But
that was my essay.
He said, it serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection.
Foments riot and insurrection?
Yeah. I left a little bit out. He actually goes on to say how it leaves us vulnerable to meddling by foreign countries. And I'm like, oh my God, he's talking about Russiagate. Russia. I was like, but I dropped that part because I didn't want to try and unpack that. But it was pretty funny.
Yes.
It jumped out at me. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it's always both a little difficult but a little fascinating to read the actual writings of the founders. You know?
Yes. It's worth doing for every American, honestly. Every American should read the founders.
Yeah, and, you know, get help interpreting them or studying the context, because their concerns are our concerns.
They really are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So historically, we've gone through at least 5 and maybe 6 so-called party eras. Historians classify these into the first party system, the second party system, et cetera.
Right.
The first was the Federalist Party and Democratic Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Then when the Democratic Republican Party came apart, we had the Whig Party and the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had an anti-slavery version of the Republican Party.
They went away.
Then the Progressive Party, which was dominated by the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Then we're into the New Deal era, where the Republican Party had a conservative and a moderate wing. Mm-hmm. So there's some debate about whether we would say that we're now today in a fifth or sixth party system.
Yeah, I could be convinced either way.
Yeah, when the current system started. So the first five systems lasted 30 to 40 years each.
Right.
So if the fifth party system ended in the 1960s, we ought to be in the sixth or seventh, honestly.
We're at the end of that system.
That's what I'm going to argue. You're jumping ahead of me.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's good. So historically, when a dominant party loses two consecutive House elections and a presidential election, that's considered to be the indication that the things have shifted.
Shifted and started. The laser
power, the locus of power has moved.
Right.
These electoral flips have been coming really quickly now, like mm-hmm. every 4 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think what we have now clearly fits this classic two-party model. I think we're basically looking at one party defined by its financing with two front offices.
Right.
Yeah.
I will say, and I hope I'm not jumping too far ahead, I think that's not an accident.
Oh, no, no.
Okay. That wasn't like, oops, look at that. Oh, what happened here?
No, especially, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit, especially now that it appears the Democratic Party has given up on the left to court the right.
Well, you know, it's how shall I say? It's given up on winning.
For the sake of financing.
Yeah.
That too. Yeah.
It's really kind of absurd, but carry on.
So the systems have degenerated too much for what we have now to really be considered a system. It's more like a churn, you know? Yeah. And it's like, ultimately, it is like a managed and wanted kind of churn.
Oh, very much.
Yeah. So historically, I think we'll mark the end of the fifth or sixth party system with Citizens United. Honestly, that's I believe that will be considered the end of that.
I think that's reasonable.
Of that system. Mm-hmm. I'm far from an expert on this, but this is just me saying dominant parties can and do collapse and get remade historically.
Oh, yes.
And so it should not be considered a stretch or even any kind of a radical position to say we've reached the end of the Democratic Party as it's been constituted in the Clinton era.
Yeah. No, that's not absurd at all. It's more absurd to think that this isn't coming or isn't about to happen or isn't in the process.
That it's going to continue long past its sell-by date.
That just hasn't happened in the past.
When it's been ineffective, it keeps losing House seats and elections.
Right. You got to, you know, it's time to rethink what's going on or just look at what's going on.
So, and back to the idea of third parties. So we've never had a stable period of three powerful parties at the presidential election level.
No.
But like, for example, before World War One,
it was awesome before World War One in lots of ways.
There were 600 socialist mayors.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't so crazy to be a socialist or even an out-and-out communist.
That you might organize with a party and win local elections and do local work. Yeah,
and honestly, I'm not really making this about Sanders per se this time, but he's really, to my view, he's just sort of channeling an older political model.
Oh, yeah. Which was a national norm until the First World War.
Yeah, especially, I don't know if he would consider Debs to be probably a hero of his.
Oh, yeah. I think that's fair.
Anyway, he might have disagreements, but
he speaks for himself.
They have a lot of influence from third parties in down ticket and local races. Mm-hmm. You have these realignments where a third party becomes one of the two major parties by kind of supplanting
it, right.
And the original sort of collapses and withers away.
Like the state.
For example, I realized as I wrote that I was channeling Karl Marx. 1856, Republicans supplanted the Whigs. 1912, Progressive Party surpassed the Republicans, and this allowed Wilson to win. Mm-hmm. So then they kind of acted as a spoiler.
The Progressives acted as a spoiler for the Republicans.
The Republicans. Oh, yeah, right. The Progressive Party acted as a spoiler, right? And that happened, historically. We're still here. It's okay. You can have spoilers. That can happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Although Wilson was a real shit.
Well, yeah. In that same election, Eugene Debs won 6% of the vote as a socialist party candidate. So... my whole point is that when a party ceases to be popular and ceases to democratically represent voters, it's vulnerable to this kind of realigning election, and also to being supplanted by a third party. For some people, including some political scientists, that is just terrifying and unacceptable, and they have to do everything they can to pretend that's not happening.
It can't happen. But it doesn't make any sense. I mean, isn't this what they study?
It almost seems like they don't study history.
Oh.
But I don't see how, I mean...
So what the hell are they doing?
I don't know. But, yeah, this was one of the other people I unfriended on Facebook.
Oh.
By the way, was a political science professor friend of mine who I knew in college.
Oh. That happens.
And I couldn't believe how...
uninformed he was about politics?
Well, how narrow his thinking was. And what a scold he was, you know.
Bad Paul, no biscuit.
I just went on and on. After I kept asking him to just drop it, you know.
Just move on, man.
And so I finally unfriended him. But I'm like, you're a department head. Jesus Christ. Are you bickering with me on Facebook about my vote?
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Don't you have some papers to grade
or something?
Sorry. You know, keep your eyes on your own paper. But if you step back historically, you might see it as a sign of health and life in the system.
Oh, yeah. It's vitality in the system.
Which has historically been very dynamic. Dynamic systems can adapt and live and evolve and become more suited to changing conditions, and static ones fail and die.
Mm-hmm.
So with all that context.
Yes.
This is the introduction.
Oh, okay.
I told you it was going to be long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have a seat.
Yeah, sorry about that, Adam. Just relax, get some tea. We're coming in for the second round now.
I want to talk about Donna Brazile's revelations, what they actually mean and how people are responding to them.
Yeah, yeah.
What I think they mean.
What do you think?
I think they're important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... I don't want to give the impression that I think she should be lauded as some kind of hero. Okay?
Oh, God, no.
She is a party hack.
She's
a partisan.
Chop, chop.
You could call her an apparatchik.
Oh. Is that an insult?
Well, if you spell it with a C-H-I-C-K, it is.
Oh.
No. I would never do that. That would be sexist. But Russia...
Stop.
Let's remember that she actually was interim chair of the DNC in 2011 and 2016. She was Al Gore's campaign manager in 2000. She worked on campaigns going back to Jesse Jackson and Walter Mondale in 1984. And she was a superdelegate. Hmm. And she's trying to sell a new book.
Oh, all of the above.
Right.
Yeah.
So
she ran Al Gore's campaign? Because that campaign sucked.
Well... Yeah,
she
wasn't so great at it.
Oh God! No wonder she like distanced her name from that. Great.
Now I'd like to say I just could pull all these facts and dates out of my head, but no, I had to get onto Wikipedia, of course.
Well, yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, but I didn't really know she'd been around for a while.
Yeah.
You know. So, this is what I like about her. Okay, she has been a voice for playing by the rules. In 2008, we had a strange situation in the Michigan primary. Do you remember the...
Drag my memory.
We went to vote in the primary, and Barack Obama was not on the ballot.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah,
I remember
it was
that.
So strange. I kind of blocked it out until I was rereading about it today.
Yeah.
But I remember going to vote in January.
Right.
Which was very unusual.
It was very early primary.
Yeah. And I couldn't even... vote for Obama. So I'm like, why the fuck am I here? So,
what's that about?
Michigan and Florida both changed their voting dates to be earlier than the party rules allowed. And so the party had said they couldn't vote before, I think it was February 5th or something right. like that. They changed them to January. Huh. They wanted to have more influence on the primary.
The who wanted to have more
the influence? The Michigan Democratic Party.
Wanted more influence in the primary.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
they moved the primary earlier.
So they moved their party primary earlier, and they broke the rules set up by the DNC.
Right.
And Brazil believed that they needed to be punished for this.
Right.
The state parties.
Okay.
And so she was opposed to seating any delegates at the convention and sticking to the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton still advocated seating all the delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Republican did the same thing, right? So Florida and Michigan, because if the Democrats are going to move, they're going to have to move too. You can't, you know. So,
all right, you got to have the primary at the same time.
So, the RNC wound up seating half their delegates. They're like, okay, you guys are going to get sanctioned. The sanction is we'll only seat half your delegates.
So there.
The DNC did wind up seating all their delegates, but gave each one half a vote.
Like, oh, same thing.
It's six of one, half dozen of the other.
Okay.
Right.
We can't do what the Republicans are doing. But, that would be weird.
So, but I do give Donna Brazile, she took a stand saying, no, there has to be a consequence for breaking
the rules.
Your rules and agreements. So she gets, in my head, some credit for standing up against two states that were trying to game the system in some way.
Like, how is this gaming? But I don't understand. Well, how is this gaming the system?
I can't.
How does it hurt? Why does it matter?
I can't go too far into that because I really don't quite understand it.
Okay.
But I just remember that as a result, several of the candidates pulled their names from the ballot.
Oh.
And I think at least one other didn't get on the ballot because the paperwork didn't
happen in
time. Didn't happen in time.
Right.
So it was a strange,
a really convoluted mess.
Right. And I'm not really sure what they thought they were achieving. So maybe someone can clarify that, or I'll have to look it up later, but that's sort of a side point. But
right. But
this is, I'm just pointing out a time when Donna Brazile like stood up for something and made a difference, and except, you know, she was overruled, but right. There it is.
But no, she stood up for following the rules, which, yeah, you know, I got respect for following the rules as long as they're not criminal rules.
And I believe in this kind of behavior because I think without the threat of whistleblowers and exposure, institutions like the DNC invariably become corrupt.
Right.
They become the slush funds
well,
for their operators.
They tend towards corruption anyway.
Sure, yeah. They do. But mm-hmm. They wind up working at cross purposes to their own charters.
Their own mission.
They become Potemkin villages pretending to operate smoothly as democratic institutions, small d.
Hmm.
Supposedly promoting the interests of their constituents while they're really being puppeted by other influences. Yeah. So, which brings us to Brazil's revelations about the DNC. So, what did she actually reveal?
Hmm.
Well, the first thing is that some of these things were actually known.
Yes.
And had received some coverage in the press.
Yes.
But usually in like the obscure
press.
Yeah, the kind of stuff that you and I read, like Common Dreams and stuff like that.
Like Truth Dig and other
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, not in Politico.
Not in Politico. It wasn't the New York Times. Wasn't CNN.
No.
Yeah, no.
But so a lot of the stuff wasn't shocking secret. The numbers were surprising, but and some of the details.
Mm-hmm.
So let's acknowledge it's standard practice for the primary winner to take over control of the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
Obama was in charge of the DNC. Actually, part of the DNC's troubles were that he kind of let it languish while he was in office as far as fundraising went.
Oh.
And so the DNC was in debt after the election and remained in debt. And
after the 2008 election?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Straight through, pretty much. And it still was in debt leading up to the primary for 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot to unpack, too, because they were paying all these consultants. It was kind of a corrupt, yeah. You know, it was just like a revolving door, like a wingnut welfare program for Democrats.
I'm telling you, I'm in the wrong business.
Yeah, well, you really got to be a consultant. You got to be a Beltway insider
but
consultant.
But then I got to say things that are... like just lies.
Lies? Oh, come on.
Okay.
You want a paycheck or you want to be a good person?
Your call.
Clinton's campaign signed an agreement. This was their big revelation, the text of the agreement, to fund the organization and control messaging and the debate schedule before the primary, almost a year before the primary.
Oh.
That's the big revelation.
So and effectively, here's the unwritten text.
Yeah.
If she does that, then they then have to give her the primary.
The entire primary process was basically mooted.
Was mooted because she was underwriting it.
Or made moot.
It was made moot because she was the underwriter of the process. So the candidate that we're trying to decide if people want, the Democrats want,
yeah,
is underwriting the primary process.
Yes.
And therefore expects to get the candidacy.
Yes. And it wasn't just underwriting. Oh. It wasn't just financial. She literally had an agreement that her staff would approve any DNC communications or documents released about any primary candidate.
Oh.
And approve hiring.
Oh.
And approve all messaging.
Huh.
So she basically was the DNC.
Was the DNC. Huh. And I suppose if she'd lost the primary, then that would be shocking. I mean, under those conditions, it would have been shocking for her to lose the primary.
Yeah.
Right.
So Jerry Riddle and Medium, the DNC worked on behalf of the Clinton campaign and against the Sanders campaign, all the while professing neutrality in that race, a neutrality mm-hmm. that is written into the DNC bylaws themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone assumed the DNC's appalling behavior, from the debate schedule fiasco to the constant efforts to smear Sanders and his supporters, the business about the data breach, the business about the accusation about chair-throwing riot by Bernie-crats. And
yeah,
because Bernie supporters are so vicious.
They're violent anarchists, Paul.
Yeah, in Nevada.
No, that's
the insistence that Sanders didn't condemn violence, you know, his all the rest, was a consequence of the DNC as... People thought that all of this was a consequence of the DNC as an independent entity improperly favoring Clinton over Sanders.
Right.
And that was like, we all thought, wow, they're really biased. There's this obvious bias going on. But he writes, it was even worse. It was all Clinton all along. She had control of all messaging.
Yes. She was doing that. She was doing it, saying
her
yeah.
hires, her mm-hmm. everything.
Right.
She signed off on every bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
So when Brazil's book excerpt came out in Politico, the pushback on Twitter started immediately. People were saying this is all just business as usual.
This is normal.
Clinton is doing the party a favor. She's funding them. She should be grateful.
He should be grateful for her love and support.
Sanders had a similar agreement.
He should be grateful.
They were saying that that this agreement only applied to the general, which was not true at all.
No.
None of this was true. Basically, everything they threw up as chaff to deflect this was not true.
It was just chaff.
Yeah. And Sanders could not have had a similar agreement.
How would that even make
sense? Would that make sense? How could he sign on to all, I'm also going to be in charge of all messaging and approve hires, right? How's that going to work? Right? Yeah. And his fundraising, so he did sign a fundraising agreement.
Yeah.
But he didn't wind up using it.
Nope.
Because his funding came, I believe, either entirely or almost entirely from small individual donations.
Oh, like some overwhelming margin. It was like not like 50%, not 60, but like 90%.
It was
some
large
margin of his funding was from small donations.
So he didn't even make use of the kind of funding agreement that Clinton had. And that funding agreement is also very interesting. You've probably heard some of the details about it, but I'll get to that too, just talk about just what that meant.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of sleazy, actually, but kind of.
The pushback also included Russian propaganda. That people claimed that Russian propaganda was behind Sanders.
Of course.
And actually,
that explains so much.
That Sanders, not Clinton, had an unfair advantage. And Hillary was just doing what little she could to defend herself.
Right.
So this...
There's so much sexism.
This con job was really just her coming up out of desperation with a way to, you know, to try to stand up to, God, I can't even say it. Straight face.
Just doing what she can.
Yeah.
Just poor little Clinton trying to get by.
This doesn't even, that argument doesn't even make any sense, because the Russian propaganda that we do know about came out for the general and not the primary. So,
how do you know that, Paul? Have you seen the documents? The Russians were engineering this election from the beginning.
You know what? I've seen the dumb ads that they ran. It almost is like those dumb YouTube videos, yeah. Like generated by bots.
Vote for Trump, yeah.
Vote? Yeah. Comrade. Comrade. Join Bernie Sanders. He give you free vodka.
Free vodka.
So to quote Riddle again, you try to craft some fake impression of a double standard to use as a weapon against Sanders. And it never, for so much as a moment, occurs to you, as you're doing so, that this behavior, the corrupt behavior you're trying to rationalize, proves Sanders was right about the establishment all along.
Yeah.
It's far worse than he'd suggested. If, of course, like most Democrats, you dislike Republican efforts to game the system to their advantage, mm-hmm. you're now the one employing the double standard.
Yeah.
You're already very down on Russian manipulation that's merely alleged, but you give Clinton's manipulation a pass.
A pass.
There's a great article in Counterpunch by Margot Kidder.
Are you...
Go ahead. Say it. Say it. Say it.
Are you kidding me?
She is. Yes, that Margot Kidder. From back in April 2016, this was on Common Dreams, entitled How Hillary Clinton Bought the Loyalty of 33 State Democratic Parties.
And this was Counterpunch or Common Dreams?
I don't know. I have to look it up. It's on my computer.
I'm thinking it was Common Dreams.
Okay. Maybe it was Common Dreams.
That's what shocked me. The idea that Margot Kidder was writing for Counterpunch.
No, you're right. They're two...
They're very different.
Yeah. Okay. Can't keep my... You know, honestly, I don't read these things that much anymore. Right.
But I know the editorial bias of each of them. So. Right. And she doesn't...
They're not my favorite sources anymore.
She doesn't map as a Counterpunch writer.
Okay. So this is quoting Margot Kidder. Yes, yeah, so we're through the looking glass, honestly. No, she's been an activist for a long time, apparently.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. So, in August 2015, at the Democratic Party convention in Minneapolis, 33 Democratic state parties made deals with the Hillary Clinton campaign and a joint fundraising entity called the Hillary Victory Fund. Victory. The deal allowed many of her core billionaire and inner circle individual donors to run the maximum amounts of money allowed through those state parties to the Hillary Victory Fund in New York and the DNC in Washington. This is long. I did edit. This is just some excerpts, right? It's a long article. But yeah. The idea was to increase how much one could personally donate to Hillary by taking advantage of the Supreme Court ruling in 2014, McCutcheon v. FEC. This is an important ruling. That knocked down the cap on aggregate limits as to how much a donor could give to a federal campaign in a year. Mm-hmm. It thus eliminated the ceiling on amounts spent by a single donor to a presidential candidate.
Right.
A single donor... by giving $10,000 a year to each signatory state, could legally give an extra $330,000 a year for 2 years to the Hillary Victory Fund. For each donor, this raised their individual legal cap on presidential campaign to $660,000 if given in both 2015 and 2016. And if you also donated an equal amount in your spouse's name, which was legal, mm-hmm. now you're talking about...
$1.2 million.
$1,320,000. Oh, is that right?
That sounds right.
Okay, she may have done her math wrong. I don't know. It's a shitload of money.
Yeah, it's
okay.
A shitload of money. Yeah.
And it's legal. So from these large amounts of money being transferred from state coffers to the Hillary Victory Fund in Washington, so they donate this shitload of money to the state, mm-hmm. they'd go to the Hillary Fund. The Clinton campaign got $2,700, the first $2,700. The DNC was to get the next 33,400, and mm-hmm. the remainder was to be split among the 33 signatory states. The 33 signatory states, for the most part, immediately sent the money back.
Right.
So, with this scheme, the Hillary Victory Fund raised over $26 million for the Clinton campaign by the end of 2015.
From 26 people.
She describes how this works in Montana. The upshot is that a whole load of billionaires, hedge fund managers, and lobbyists who have no business in Montana, no relationship to Montana, don't live there, don't vacation there, don't have employees there or anything.
Nothing.
Each gave the Montana State Democratic Party $10,000 in 2015. Because they were given out to all the signatory states.
Right.
Kidder explains, the agreement with the Hillary Victory Fund and the DNC could solve some of the Montana State Democratic Party's financial troubles while simultaneously funding several state and federal candidates. But the scheme would only make sense as a benefit to the parties involved if the money raised actually stayed in the states that received the initial checks. Mm-hmm. This did not happen. The Montana State Democratic Party received $43,500 from the Hillary Victory Fund on November 2nd, 2015. On that same day, it transferred $43,500 back to the DNC in Washington. And on December 1st, it received another $20,600 from the Hillary Victory Fund. And on the same day, the Montana State Democratic Party sent that exact same amount, $20,600, back to the DNC in Washington as well.
So, how does this help?
It allows people to donate large amounts of money to Hillary's campaign by sending the money through several different accounts.
You mean money laundering?
It is money laundering.
Oh.
If it was any kind of a business transaction, this would be considered money laundering.
This would be a crime.
Yes. It okay. was not a crime.
Yeah, it was not a crime. But it's money laundering. Just not because
it's just political nature. It's literally just a workaround for right. avoiding campaign spending limits by taking advantage of this loophole. Aggregate limit.
Right.
So.
Okay. Right. Carry on.
So CNBC, this is a different person now. Jordan Cheriton explained, basically, in exchange for raising money for a near-bankrupt DNC, the deal provided the Clinton campaign with advanced screening of communications sent out about other primary candidates during the primary, and gave it, as Brazil pointed out, and the documents confirmed, control over which of the two candidates previously identified as acceptable to HFA, Hillary for America, would be hired as DNC communications director. Just to make sure we're clear, this happened almost a year before the primary.
Before the primary ever started, right.
She got to basically appoint DNC staff, had control over messaging.
Right.
I mean, it's worse than this. There's more detail about the exact details of the agreement, but these are the big ones. Mm-hmm. Cheriton continues, does any objective person think the Clinton campaign, when given the say-so on who the DNC communications chair would be hiring, would be during the primary, wouldn't try to ram through a communications director who benefited them immediately, thus helping them to become the general election candidate?
Hmm.
The DNC hired Louis Miranda, a veteran communications operative for establishment figures, including John Kerry and President Obama. WikiLeaks revealed he worked overtime behind the scenes on behalf of DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was Clinton's 2008 primary co-chair, to plant hit pieces on Bernie Sanders in media outlets during the primary, mm-hmm. which ultimately got him fired when Brazil cleaned house.
Oh, yeah.
So another, like, chalk one up for Brazil doing a little bit of a right thing.
Almost the right thing.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the right thing would have been to call bullshit and all this at the time.
Out the whole right. damn thing.
That would have been the right thing, but, you know, whatever. Right.
This is Cheriton, Jordan Cheriton, continuing. Sorry, it was Louis Miranda, L-U-I-S.
Right, not Louis.
Does any objective person think the DNC wasn't making decisions like planting debates at dead zones, like Saturday night before Christmas, having its chairwoman go on national television to falsely declare chairs were thrown by Sanders supporters at the Nevada State Convention with zero video evidence of such right. violence, due to the fact that the DNC had handled over handed over sizable control over finances, staffing, and messaging to Clinton in order to, in exchange for Hillary keeping the money flowing into the DNC.
Right.
If you want to see some great examples of this, read Thomas Frank's article in Harper's November 2016, mm-hmm. entitled SWAT Team. Mm-hmm. It's about how Sanders was covered by the Washington Post.
Oh, that was so...
And how they literally turned on him on a dime and became like just a ridiculous number of hit pieces, really ridiculous hit pieces.
Right.
They were planted there.
They were planted.
That was planned and organized by the DNC in their contacts. And meanwhile, their coverage of Clinton was like 50-50. And before this turn, they had been relatively even-handed towards Sanders, too.
Yes.
Maybe a bit more skeptical, but not... They weren't blatant hit pieces piling on left and right. It's a pretty fascinating and horrifying article. But democracy dies in darkness. Cheriton says, I've never before seen the press take sides like they did this year. Oh, no, this is, sorry, this is Thomas Frank now. Mm-hmm. I've never before seen the press take sides like they did this year, openly and even gleefully bad-mouthing candidates who did not meet with their approval. This shocked me when I first noticed it. It felt like the news stories went out of their way to mock Sanders or to twist his words, while the op-ed pages, which of course don't pretend to be balanced, seemed to be of one voice in denouncing my candidate. I mean, Frank doesn't make any secret of the fact that he was a Sanders voter.
Right.
So, I take a deep breath. So, head's going to explode.
Just count.
Yeah. Anyway. To be clear, the DNC charter reads, the chairperson shall exercise impartiality and even-handedness as between the presidential candidates and campaigns. The chairperson shall be responsible for ensuring that the national officers and staff of the Democratic National Committee maintain impartiality and even-handedness during the Democratic Party presidential nominating process.
Yes. Which would be the reason people gave them individual donations.
Clinton's agreement with the DNC actually contained the following text. Nothing in this agreement shall be construed to violate the DNC's obligation of impartiality and neutrality through the nominating process.
Well, of course not. How could it?
So,
with a straight face?
It's just not possible that those realities can overlap.
What color is the sky there, bro?
It's matter and antimatter.
What color is the sky anyway, on your
but
planet?
That was some lawyer saying, oh, shouldn't we put something in there? This isn't actually designed to look impartial.
This isn't actually designed to circumvent the entire party process. Okay.
As if the memo and the charter could coexist in some kind of sensible way, which they
right,
can't.
They
so.
Can't but,
all right. So, hey, we're almost done, actually.
Okay.
We're getting up to the present here. Mm-hmm. Let's remember that when Sanders' supporters sued the party in Florida on the grounds that it was blatantly partial, the DNC's defense in Florida court mm-hmm. was to claim that they were under no obligation to provide fair primaries.
Oh.
So I was just reading.
So it can all be a sham. Keep voting for us. It's all a sham.
I was actually reading the transcript of motion hearing had before the Honorable William J. Zloch, United States District Judge. I read that this afternoon. This was a class action suit against DNC Services Corp. Hmm. That's the legal branch of DNC. Okay. And Debbie Washing Machine Schultz.
Hey now, don't make fun of her name.
Sorry. One of the Chapo guys insists on calling her Debbie Washing Machine Schultz, and it's really childish. But
I'm terribly childish.
Debbie Wasserman.
Too far. Even for
it's too far. He's gone too far. Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The plaintiffs were residents of 45 states and the districts of Columbia, who contributed to the Sanders campaign and the DNC, as well as all registered Democrats. Those were the plaintiffs listed in the suit.
Mm-hmm.
Three different classes.
Am I part of that suit? I don't think so. Okay.
The plaintiffs claimed fraud, misrepresentation, unjust enrichment, breach of fiduciary duty, and negligence.
Oh.
So the DNC's attorney was this guy, Bruce V. Spiva.
Hmm. Never heard of him.
He testified in a Speedo. Spiva in a Speedo.
No, come on. Stop that.
He made various claims before the judge. Among the claims, he actually said, and I'm trying to, this is like a court transcript, so it's, the language is a little...
It's a little dry, but it's okay.
Well, no, it's hard. He was stuttering, and, you know.
Oh, sure. We're grown-ups here. We stutter.
I think there's an impossible showing of causation. I mean, the court would have to find that people who fervently supported Bernie Sanders and who purportedly didn't know that this favoritism was going on would have not given to Mr. Sanders, to Senator Sanders, if they had known that there was this purported favoritism. Now, I went through this whole document and it hurt my brain, I have to say. But yeah. I did feel like I understood his arguments, and they're all very technical.
Right.
Like, you are technically correct. The best kind of correct. So he's saying basically an impossible showing of causation. In other words, it wouldn't be possible to show
right.
that if people knew the process was corrupt, they wouldn't have contributed to Sanders.
Right. Except that they're bringing suit because they wouldn't have given to Sanders if they'd known it was
very,
corrupt.
It's very, not solipsistic, but... sophists kind
it's
of
very sophist.
Game sophistry. Yeah.
It never, I will admit though, I have to admit, it never quite made sense to me.
The lawsuit idea. No.
It's really just like,
it was a protest.
Are so
pissed
off, they had to do something.
Yeah. It was a protest suit. They wanted to get this kind of out in public.
Right.
In other words, he claimed that it was impossible to prove that Sanders supporters wouldn't have not given if they had known the DMC was completely biased and had their thumbs on the scales. So he makes a complex argument that has multiple legal prongs, but there is one particularly startling quote, which has been in the media before. But mm-hmm. And then in terms of concrete injury, which was really the first prong, that again is problematic because, and this goes back to your honor's question, there is no right to, just by virtue of making a donation, to enforce the party's internal rules. And there's no right to not have your candidate disadvantaged or have another candidate advantage. There's no contractual obligation here. That really hinges on what kind of definition you have of a contract. I mean, nobody's, when you donate money, you don't get a signed affidavit back from your party saying, right. Here's what we're going to use your money for. That doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. And to some extent, it doesn't exist with any nonprofit, right?
Right.
You send them a donation. I mean, you've got, but there are very clear expectations about what the donation's for.
So he continues to argue that in questions of, quote, how the party runs itself, how it decides who it's going to associate with, how it decides how it's going to choose its standard bearer, that it's the party's right to make that determination. And they are, quote, internal issues that the party gets to decide basically without interference from the court, end quote. And I think that's actually true.
Yeah, that's true.
Because what's the alternative, right?
Yeah.
He then compares the DNC to a charity and how... If you gave money to a charity, you have
a charity case.
basket case. You have an expectation that if they pocketed the money instead of putting it towards the specific purpose you gave it for, you might have a case. But when it comes to expecting the party to represent your preference, you don't have a case because the DNC could have, and then this is a quote, voluntarily decided that, look, we're going to go into back rooms like they used to and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. That's not the way it was done, but they could have, and that would have also been their right, end quote. This was the DNC's argument for why they didn't have to represent voters.
Noted. Well, basically, though, he kind of set up the argument. I think you could prove that, in effect, they'd pocketed the money and didn't do what was expected.
That's exactly what happened.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and they don't have a right to pocket the money.
And not do anything for it.
Not do anything for it. Right.
So So this, now we're coming to the last,
the last bit,
bit here.
Okay. So, section three.
I don't even have markers. It's just one big wall of text. On this. I just start typing, you know.
I hear you. It's a luxury denied to many.
Okay, blah, blah, blah. Oh, so this may all be technically correct from a legal standpoint, but to me, this is really a, quote, naked lunch, unquote, moment, which is when suddenly the light comes on and you get to see what's actually on everybody's fork.
Right.
Oh, my God, what are you eating? I've been running on for a while on this subject. What's the upshot? What's the bottom line? What's the bottom line?
What does this mean?
So this is when I try to... boil this whole thing down to what it actually means to me and mm-hmm. should mean to you. I try to argue that's what it should mean to you.
Okay.
And again, you're welcome to try and talk me out of it or talk me down. Mm-hmm. After the election, the Democrats were claiming that, hey, Sanders people, just shut up. Clinton won the primary fair and square.
Right, come on.
Between superdelegates and the contribution scheme and the vetting scheme and messaging control a year before the primary, they can no longer make this argument.
Can't make that claim.
We can say we have a mountain of evidence that suggests that it was not fair and square.
Well, and for me, what it comes, what that comes down to,
yeah.
I kind of don't have a horse in this race.
Yeah.
Right.
But, given that there was no chance you were ever going to vote for a Democrat, was little chance I was going to either.
Right,
but
so that wasn't
going to
happen.
But those were the arguments I engaged
in. Those are the arguments, right? The arguments people had. I think given that that was just an outright falsehood,
yeah.
What this amounts to is that, in effect, it is these machinations that gave us Trump. Not third-party voters, but
yes,
these machinations.
That's my belief.
That brought 45 into office.
Especially when you look at polling right after the election, you really see that if the polls were accurate, Sanders in a straight-up race would have beat Trump. And it's, you can't prove that.
Yeah, no, you can't prove that. And I actually, personally, I kind of remain unconvinced.
Sure. There's lots of gaffes that could have happened.
Oh, so many things.
Maybe he collapses on stage. Whatever. Lots of things that could have happened. Maybe there's a skeleton in his closet that hasn't already.
Bagel scandal.
But a bagel scandal. Did you see? Do you see how much lox he puts on his bagels?
Outrageous.
He's gonna die.
No. He may.
I said I want a lot of cream cheese. I will not be taking questions. You have to tell that story now.
Okay, I have to tell the story. Yeah. No, we're going like down three layers deep in Inception. So when I came to Michigan a million years ago, I moved here from the East Coast.
Before the Anthropocene.
And I, being from the East Coast, you know, we eat bagels there with lox and cream cheese. And for the uninitiated, really? Lox is smoked salmon.
That's delicious.
And it seems so mundane. It seems mundane now. But in the early 90s...
It seemed like it ought to be a no-brainer to get lox and a bagel with lox.
Right? Yeah. It just seemed so right. Basic, right?
Right, right?
But I'd been here for like 6 months, 9 months, almost a year. And I hadn't had one. And I was really kind of jonesing for one.
Yeah,
and no, I couldn't find a decent bagel.
I jones
anywhere.
For one every once in a while, and I'm not even from there.
Right? And you know, and really it's just sort of classic with the tomato, the red onion, you know.
Oh, stop. It's salivating.
So I was driving through this area and like, was it north of here? Northville, I think is the name.
Northville, yeah.
And there's this place
Einstein's.
Called the, no, it was not Einstein's, it was the New York Bagel Factory.
Like, yeah, baby.
All right, bring it. I'm wheel through the drive through, put down my money to give me a bagel with lox and cream cheese. And I wait and I wait and I wait. And they give me the bagel, and I drive off, and I'm unwrapping my prize. And there's like 3 inches, like a 3-inch slab of cream cheese on this bagel.
And no lox.
And no lox. It's nothing else. Just
they heard you say lots of cream cheese.
They had no idea what the hell I was talking
about. I'm beginning to think they weren't even from Manhattan.
Exactly. So it's a standing joke in the Potts household.
Lots of cream cheese.
Lots of cream cheese on that bagel. Mm. No, you schmear the cream cheese.
A schmear, can you define schmear? I
mean, schmear is like it's a table knife full of cream cheese, and you spread it smoothly.
It's a modest amount.
It's a modest
amount. You're not actually gagging down mouthfuls of cream cheese.
It's like you might butter a bagel. You would smear it with cream cheese.
It's not that much.
Not that much.
Maybe a little more than you'd use for butter, but not that much. More.
Yeah.
I don't know. Everyone probably defines you've got your schmear, I've got my schmear.
You get your yeah. But no, it's it's arguable for me whether or not Sanders would have won the election. But I think he was the only candidate running that could have beaten Trump.
That had the chance. Yeah.
But it was the Clinton campaign that brought Trump to the table as a candidate.
Right. And then there's the whole Pied Piper strategy thing where they...
Which was their idea.
Was part of their whole plan. So.
And then failed to beat him in the general.
Right.
So really, I think if you're foaming at the mouth about Russia and you're foaming at the mouth about, you know, 45 being in office, what a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was your party that brought this.
Yeah. And
don't talk to me about anything.
And we're not exactly going to say I'm a fan of Trump and his policies.
Oh.
But every day I actually wake up and do breathe a brief sigh of relief before I get on Twitter and see what Trump's been producing along with his morning bowel movements. You know, I breathe a brief sigh of relief that Hillary Rodham Clinton is not president. I do.
Yeah, no, that was actually a real relief for me.
Yeah. Yeah. But not that I look forward to anything 45 is going to...
Oh, no. No.
...going to do.
I mean, and like even... Who would? I don't think even his supporters do.
No. They're a little fed up.
Yeah. And just don't care. They're just glad that their guy won.
Yeah.
You know?
They're I don't know. Anyway. So, this was my point, this is a topic sentence, okay?
Here's your topic sentence.
Democrats were claiming that Clinton won the primary, quote, fair and square, unquote. But everything that we've learned reveals that they can't make that argument, or at least they can't convince me of that argument anymore.
No.
Neither fair nor square. My Clinton supporter friends have been telling me I just need to grow up. I need to realize that this is how it's always been done. And... Yeah. It's what I should expect. But to me, this is Chicago machine politics.
Yeah, it's gross.
If we want to retain any ability to criticize corruption, remember that bit about hypocrisy, in others, you really can't only call it out when it happens to the other party.
No, we have to call it out, period.
Yes. So the DNC is long past due for an intervention. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
Last page. Even Tim Kaine is calling for an end to the superdelegate system now. Because that was a clusterfuck. Superdelegates were part of it. And recently, though, the DNC just appointed a bunch of new ones, lobbyists and hedge fund managers. It's just straight up patronage.
Yeah.
The whole donation arrangement was oriented this way, not because it was the only way, but because it supports the consultant class and the patronage system they've set up.
Mm-hmm.
So the breakdown of money is complicated because if you try and look up how much did each candidate raise, it's very complicated.
Yes.
Because it includes PACs, super PACs, party funds, outside donors. I can't begin to figure it out. But Sanders actually... raised over $200 million, almost all of it from small individual donations, averaging, I've heard slightly different figures, $27.
Yeah. I mean,
some of them were... People gave him $25 and $30 or less.
Right.
And he had, like, when he was on the debate and asked for donations and mentioned BernieSanders.com, that night he got like $5 million. He was getting like $48 donations a minute or something like that. It was impressive.
It's very impressive.
He had the ability to raise a lot of funds.
Yeah.
Trump didn't raise even half what Clinton did. She raised, do I have this down here? She raised over $1 billion and lost.
And lost. I don't understand how the... All right. So the Dem faithful, for some... reason I cannot comprehend.
Yeah.
Like her. They like her for some reason.
To some extent, I really believe it is a cult of personality.
But they're into
your abuela, you know.
Okay, so that's how you feel, and that's what you like, okay? I like liver,
but
okay?
I
love liver. I love liver and onions.
Yeah.
At the same time, I comprehend that other people don't want to eat it.
You can't say bad things about mother. You can't do it.
So
it's out of bounds.
But how can they not understand
if you do that?
That other people don't like her? But they really, like, no one except them likes her.
So the Democrats who are comfortable with this whole DNC thing,
yeah,
with the fundraising and the control agreements and all that, and they're like, that's just the way it is, grow up. I think we need to ask them, would you just be comfortable handing over the choice of candidates to a board, say the board of Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, we could just let Goldman Sachs.
Because that would save us all a lot of
grief. So much time. And money. It would save so much money.
The primaries are endless.
You know, endless, they're expensive.
I don't know if you... People have blocked out what an unpleasant experience that was this time, but it just dragged on forever.
Oh, gosh. At one point, Veronica was like, so, who's the president now? We're like, Barack Obama.
We still have 6 months to go.
What? No, seriously, you guys haven't had the election yet?
I haven't decided yet. It's been a year.
Like a year like this.
Oh, it's awful.
but seriously, it's hard
to imagine.
It's
exhausting for them, too.
Yeah.
I mean, even the strong ones, we do see them start to mentally unravel on the campaign trail.
Coming to pieces.
They're like, Sanders was doing, you know, in states, he'd do like 40, 50 rallies, you know. It's pretty robust, but he's 72, 73, yeah, you know, and it's got to be hard. And I mean, I can imagine just getting up there at some point, not knowing where you are. You look out and you just start speaking in tongues or something. You start gibbering. I say, "Hail Satan."
But I think if you phrased the question the right way.
Yeah.
The answer for the dim faithful would be yes.
Would be yes.
Just like Goldman Sachs decide who the candidate is.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. That's what we trust the rich.
We trust them.
Because
and that's why they're right wingers.
Because that they are right wingers.
That's why they're right wingers.
Our interests are their interests. What's good for business is good for us.
It's good for us.
We glorious few proud identity liberals.
Yeah. And they don't understand that that is what makes them a fascist.
It's just being on the right.
Well, I wouldn't say every right winger is a fascist. I'm not going to go there.
Right.
I have friends that would, but I'm not there.
No, it's the being on the right and basically agreeing that corporate control of government and government
is how
control
we're
of corporations.
This. That's how we're going to do
is,
this.
Is okay. It's one
it's
and
okay.
the same thing.
It's one of the same thing, and I'm
it's
okay with that.
The system, the establishment.
And it's good for us as long as, you know, transgenders can serve in the military.
Yeah. And
then I'm good.
And what people weren't talking about is just how very far economically all of us continue to fall. And it's only been downhill.
It's been free
for
fall.
All of Clinton, all the Clinton years, all the Obama years, you know.
And the Bush years in between.
Going back to before Carter.
Yeah, it's been about 40 years of free fall.
It's about... So the phrase is utopia ended in 1972 as far as economic prosperity. Anyway, so Goldman Sachs, Hillary's biggest donors were Paloma Partners, Pritzker Group, Renaissance Technology, Saban Capital Group, NewsWeb Corp, Soros Fund Management, among them also Microsoft, Alphabet, that's Google, Apple, J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, Time Warner, Kaiser Permanente, Wells Fargo, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also told that I hear people saying, it's time to stop relitigating the election.
Yeah.
My response to that is what we've learned from all of this is that we never litigated the election.
It never happened. We never litigated.
It was never fairly and properly litigated. And if that happens in a trial, you get a mistrial.
You get a mistrial and you do it again.
So I'm declaring a mistrial, and so are millions of other Americans. And it's going to have to be litigated somehow, this thing between the populist wings, the people, and the centrist party, that has to be litigated. If we want Americans to have any trust in the system, to have any participation, to get anything from their tax money, to get everything from their government, to get anything out of this system, when they put so much effort and faith and trust into it.
Right.
And that, if we don't have trust in our parties, we have to change them. And that is the American way. There. I got to the end.
Woo! You knew it could happen. You knew it was possible.
So
there it is.
There it is. Any closing thoughts? I'm sorry it was so long. You can see why I wanted to get the whole argument out, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know that there's really a good way forward. I mean,
I don't either.
We have these ideas about, well, if this, then that, then maybe, possibly, I don't know, we could all keep going.
Yeah, it's very uncertain how we get out of this.
I
without la guillotine.
La guillotines. Well,
to the barricades.
I don't think that's not going to be how Americans do it.
No, it's not.
It's not going to be how Americans do it.
No, not really.
I really think that we will know after it's happened that it happened.
The revolution will not be televised. So
we'll only know in retrospect.
Right.
And that, I hope things continue on for our family with general safety and whatnot.
We really hope for stability, but stability is not possible, and so we hope for positive change.
Exactly. Exactly. I hope the changes are positive, but things seriously have to change.
Absolutely.
On a fundamental level, they have to change.
Yeah.
And
if for no other reason than total environmental collapse.
For example.
And total economic collapse. And a few other minor details.
Details.
Like that.
Soil collapse, nutritional collapse.
So this is my farewell to the Democratic Party. And I have not voted Democrat for quite a few elections now. Right. But this is why.
Yeah, that's why. So it happens. It's the way it goes.
Yes.
And it's okay. Just so you know, it's actually okay. Paul will be fine about the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party will also continue without Paul. And it's okay.
I'm thinking of joining the DSA. That's one possibility.
Yeah. You could do that.
I haven't really committed to them yet. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to have a little rose in my Twitter handle.
Oh, that would be pretty.
Some
bread too.
But I don't know if they're the people I really identify with.
It's a good question.
I'm just not good at parties, you know. I'm not good at it's like the Groucho Marx joke. I'd hate to belong to a club that would have me as a member.
That's true. Yeah, there's that. So yeah, it's hard to know where your political home is. Apparently I've been a distributist
your whole life.
I just didn't know.
Yeah, I haven't really found the ideology that says I read this and, oh, that's me. I don't believe I've really changed. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, no, people never knew me, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
All right. And I just was, for many years, I was just like, all right, well, I'm willing to compromise because I'm doing what everyone does, you know, like voting for Bill Clinton.
Everyone's doing this. I guess that's me too.
And I guess I kind of...
I didn't. I never voted for a Clinton. I have never voted for a Clinton.
I wonder if you had been 5 or 6 years older, if you might have. I don't know.
I don't know.
But
I voted for Jerry Brown once, this one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still ashamed about that.
How does that make you feel?
I'm really ashamed, actually.
Yeah.
Like, every time he opens his mouth, I'm just like, I want to vomit. Mm. Like, how did I vote for that? Jesus.
Well.
But, hey, you know, you do what you can.
I voted for Obama once, so.
Well, you know.
All right. We're going to wind this up. This was.
Because you're not racist.
We're going to.
sorry.
That you know of. We're going to put this in a can, and I think I'm going to save it to release on Thanksgiving weekend, just because on Thanksgiving weekend, everyone needs more political argument in their lives.
Exactly.
You're sick of all this happy talk with your families.
Get none of that. All the like
no politics.
Your turkey.
So you're gonna want this to get your blood pressure up, so you can stay awake long enough to drive to work on Monday. Yeah. Anyway, smash your Keurigs.
Have a happy Thanksgiving.
You heard that Volvo also pulled their advertiser.
Smash your Volvos.
Drive over their Keurigs with their Volvos. Anyway, bye everyone.